were here called Edge Media TV, and they touched on a lot of controversial subjects that you don't hear in the mainstream. And there was one interview, and they were interviewing Andrew about the events of 9/11. And he had a completely different view to what most, I mean, most of us all know it was a, you know, an inside job. We all know that. And we all kind of went with the, you know, the controlled demolition and the nanothermite and all of this. And then I listened to what Andrew had to say, and at first I didn't quite kind of, you know, believe it. I thought, no, this can't be right. But then, you know, I went, he gave out the websites, and we looked at it. And he was working with a Dr. Judy Wood in the States, who I think is a physicist. And basically, it looks like some kind of Star Wars-directed energy weapon was used here, or possibly was used. I mean, there's a lot of evidence to show that it was. So it's intriguing, to say the least. And it is, throws a totally different light on the events of 9/11 and could have huge implications, because these directed energy weapons obviously could be put to good use. And here they were using it against the people. And, you know, we all know what happened on 9/11. 3,500 people were killed, and then a couple of million in subsequent wars. So this is important stuff, I think. And so we're glad to have Andrew on, if he's there.
I'm here.
Hello, Andrew. Welcome to the show, Coffee and Cigarettes.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, not a problem. So that was a brief introduction. I'm sure you've got an awful lot more to enlighten us on.
Sure.
Maybe you could tell us how it all started for you. How did you get going on all of this?
Well, I've sort of had an interest in the sort of things like UFO stuff and all that kind of stuff for most of my life, really. Although it's, you know, just been an interest up until about 2003. And that's when, you know, the broadband revolution started to take hold in the UK in around about 2002, 2003. And it became, you know, more affordable to somebody like myself. I decided to take the plunge and get the broadband when it started to come in our area. And so I, you know, was able to download as much as I liked and go onto all these websites that I'd never had, you know, been able to go onto before because of dial-up costs and all that type of thing. And I came across this site called Disclosure Project, which was actually to do with disclosures relating to the UFO issue. And it was a chap called Dr. Stephen Greer who put this together. And, you know, a lot of military people, very credible witnesses, very highly qualified. And I was a bit flabbergasted, actually, by this because, you know, I'd always suspected that something was going on with the UFO issue more than, you know, a lot of people were willing to say. But then when we had all these guys coming forward and talking about nuclear weapon systems being shut down, you know, you know, craft being recovered and all this type of thing, and they were saying this in the National Press Club in Washington D.C., you know, which is a very prestigious venue. I thought, well, this proves there's been a cover up. You know, there's no doubt in my mind that this was a cover up with all this stuff. And so, you know, I explored that for quite a few months actually, and did various things with that. And I started to read some articles relating to what was called false flag terrorism, and I thought. In fact, no, it wasn't that. It was called state-sponsored terrorism. It wasn't. I hadn't come across the expression of false flag terrorism. And it started off. The first thing I came across was state-sponsored terrorism. I thought, well, what's that? I've never heard of that before. And you know, so I started reading about that, and I found a film by a chap called George Humphrey, who made a film called 9/11: The Great Illusion, which I think is still out there on the net somewhere. And the thing that really sort of held my attention in that the most was the destruction of the towers, because this video showed the destruction of the towers, and it pointed out that the towers came down in 8 seconds and 10 seconds, you know, approximately, respectively. And I thought, oh, that's a bit strange, and I'd never really sort of taken that in before, even though I did, you know, like everyone else, I saw it on the TV, and I watched whatever, you know, about, I think it was about what was it, 3 PM or something when it happened to you, something like that, spelt that, something like that. And so I watched this here and I was absolutely, you know, shocked by it all. But I hadn't really thought about it for about almost 3 years, really. And so, you know, I saw this film and I looked at the thing and it said it was 8 seconds and I thought, well, let's just go back to the equations of motion because my background is in physics and software engineering. So, you know, I remembered all the equations of motion that were being taught in my physics at school. And sure enough, you know, I did a little calculation. Yep, they came down at free fall speed. And I think there was another film by a chap called Eric Hufschmid, and he basically described it thus. He said it's impossible for a building to fall through itself faster or at the same speed as it falls through thin air. And I thought, well, of course it is, because, you know, the building isn't thin air. The building's a building. And so the George Humphrey film said, you know, it must have been explosives planted. And I thought, well, it must have been. It must have been explosives because it can't have just fallen down, and it can't have been these plane crashes which caused us to burn and then came down because it burned, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I started posting this little calculation that I'd done. I think the one or two versions out there already, you know, of this calculation, which is based on one of the equations of motion, S equals UT plus half AT squared, and then the first term drops to zero UT, which is the initial velocity times time. The initial velocity is zero for free fall, so you just have S equals a half AT squared. And so I put this little calculation out there, and there was a physics forum that I found, and I just thought, well, this seems a logical place to post this on this physics forum and see how other people react to this. And as with a lot of these forum postings, this thread that I started on this forum, it grew and grew and grew, and I think it ended up being 155 pages of forum posts, which ran for about, I don't know, about 18 months, 2 years, before it was eventually closed or locked by the forum moderators, and there are all kinds of stuff posted on there.
Hold on, guys. I hear the music coming in the background. Andrew, hold on to that.
No problem.
I hear the music coming in, and we shall be right back after this. And welcome back to Coffee and Cigarettes here on the Orion Talk Radio Network. I'm here with Breiser and Andrew Johnson. Andrew, pick up where you left off at. This was getting interesting.
Sure, thanks. Yeah, so, you know, I'd gone initially to the sort of bombs in the building explanation because that was the only way I could initially see, you know, that's what, you know, explained what happened to the buildings, and, you know, and they were blown up and, you know, came down. And I sort of started writing letters to, you know, I wrote a couple of letters to my MP, political representative in this country, and I put this you know, expression in the equation that I'd written out, and pointed out this essentially disproved the official story on its own. You didn't really need anything else to disprove the official story. You know, and at that time there were a couple of small groups forming in the UK. There was a couple of people getting together in London, and then a few more people got together with them, and, you know, and I got involved in that a bit. They set up a website, they set up a UK 9/11 forum, and I got involved with helping to set that up a bit. Or I didn't do all of it. I just helped with a bit of moderation, and there were a couple of problems setting up the website, so I helped with that. So I started to get quite involved in the 9/11 stuff, and then it was at the end of 2005. Where I actually got this email from this Stephen E. Jones character, who is this physicist at Brigham Young University. And I'd seen, he was on the Tucker Carlson show. I'd seen that broadcast, I think, a couple of months prior to that. And he'd started to try and form this Scholars for 9/11 Truth group. And he'd done this with another character called Jim Fetzer, who I was already familiar with because he'd been involved with some of the JFK research, and I'd heard him on Coast to Coast, I think, once or twice, or come across some of the audio downloads off him. So I knew of him, And then they invited me to join this group, and I thought, oh, you know, that's, here's me in the UK, you know, on my own, doing my own thing, and they're inviting me to join the scholars group. And part of the reason why I was invited to join the scholars group was because I'd been posting this on this physics forum, and I was also associated with the Open University, which I still am. I actually earn my living from the Open University. I'm not on the academic staff. For those that don't know what the Open University is, it's actually a university in the UK, but it runs just about all of its courses through correspondence. So they're all done through now over the web. They used to be all done by post. You know, they'd post you out a book and you'd read the book and study it, and then you'd have a tutor who you could ask questions of, and then they'd send you an assignment. So anyway, I'm associated with an Open University. I still am. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a professor, nothing like that. But I have in the past, you know, taken classes. I still do 4 classes a year. So I got involved in the scholars group, and I, you know, helped produce a little video clip for Steve Jones with this thermite stuff, and he claimed to have this video of molten material coming out of the tower, and I edited that together with another video from a TV program in the UK called Brainiac, which shows a thermite demonstration. And so I thought, oh, yeah, we can see the molten material coming out of the building, and we can see this is the same color as this thermite. So, yeah, it must be thermite, you know, and that's what I thought. And then some odd things started to go on because I think it was, it was about 6 months later, I came across this paper by Dr. Morgan Reynolds and Dr. Judy Wood. And they were basically sort of criticizing what Stephen E. Jones had been doing, the way he'd been putting forward this thermite paper. Stephen E. Jones wrote this scientific paper, you know, about the thermite. And I'd read this paper, and I actually passed a few comments back on it. I think it was just some punctuation or something, which I thought was wrong. So I sent some comments about that, and I assumed that this guy was legit. Basically, I assumed he was genuine. He's from Brigham Young University. I think he was a tenured professor there. And so I thought, well, this guy must know what he's doing. You know, I'm not a professor or anything like that. So I kind of trusted that this guy was above board. But then, as I say, we got this paper from Dr. Judy and Morgan Reynolds, Dr. Morgan Reynolds, and they were criticising the thermite and said, well, no, what Jones has put on the table certainly doesn't prove thermite at all. And they were starting to point out some other factors. This was mainly Dr. Judy who'd done this, that she'd pointed out that the buildings actually didn't burn down. And that's one of the problems. I mean, you just got to look at the evidence. You look at, for example, the paper in the streets. We've all seen the voluminous paper which came out and landed on the streets. Now, if the buildings burned down, how come the paper was there? You know, if this thermite reaction, which is a very, very hot reaction, which runs at about, I think it's 1,500 degrees centigrade, about 2,400 Fahrenheit or something, with that sort of temperature, you're just going to get an incineration of paper and wood and all those sorts of materials. And the byproduct of this is molten iron. And so if this building was taken down with thermite, then you would have had a huge sort of amount of molten material, you know, coming down to the ground, and huge fireball with very, very hot temperatures, which would have incinerated everything into much greater degree than we actually saw. Now, at the time, I didn't really stop and think about that, but fortunately, somebody like Dr. Judy Wood, she had stopped and thought about that and shown the evidence to actually prove that what she was saying was correct. So I began to doubt the what Stephen E. Jones was saying was true. But I was still kind of carried along, you know, with the momentum of this scholars group, and they were, you know, writing press releases and saying, oh, you know, we've got all these academics who are saying, you know, the official story is wrong. I thought, well, this is great, because, you know, if people have got to listen to the academics, you know, and they've got to do something. So I was carried along with the momentum of that. But then over time, I became more and more unhappy with the way that, for example, Stephen E. Jones seemed to be ignoring the free fall issue, which I thought was very fundamental. He didn't really seem interested in the free fall issue. And then I found out, I think it was, when was it, probably late 2006, I think, that Stephen E. Jones had a history, and he had a very significant history. And that very significant history was that he was involved with something called cold fusion, or that was the name that was given to it. And I believe, actually, I found this out even later, that the name cold fusion, which I'll describe in a minute, that name was given by Stephen E. Jones himself, as I understand it. So I found out that Stephen E. Jones had been involved in cold fusion research, which is basically an energy phenomenon which was discovered in the late 1980s by two electrochemists called Martin Fleischmann and Stanley Pons. And they had actually basically seemed to have found a way to do kind of nuclear power in a test tube on the desktop. Nuclear fusion power, this is. There's basically two types of nuclear power. There's the one that we use now, and that's fission power. Fission means breaking it. In other words, it's the breaking of the atom. You split the atom. And fusion is where you join two nuclei together and draw power from that.
Andrew, the music is coming in again. Okay. So we're going to break. So we'll come back to this. This is just... we're not even touching on it yet, guys, but you have to know about this. So we'll be back to you soon. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Coffee and Cigarettes on the Orion Talk Radio Network. This is Breiser here along with Chris Kemp. Our special guest from the UK, Andrew Johnson, who has certainly given us a very alternative view to actually what happened on 9/11, and I think it's quite significant. So, Andrew, you had the floor there, and we'll give it back to you again.
Thank you very much. Thanks. We were just talking about basically what I'm trying to show here is the connection into the energy cover-up and 9/11, and this is really one of the main bits of this is through Stephen E. Jones. And, we have these two chemists in 1989 who created quite a fuss in the science community with this cold fusion process, which they'd been working on for 5 years. And Stephen E. Jones's role in this was basically, we've come up with this term, I don't know if we coined it, but it's a term we use a lot, limited hangout. In other words, Stephen E. Jones didn't say that what Pons and Fleischmann did was a fraud, or other people said that. He didn't. He actually released a paper on muon-catalyzed cold fusion. Now, I was starting to mention that fusion power is where you get two nuclei from an atom, and you get them to fuse together. And in that process, you get what's called binding energy released. I understand some of this because I did some of the physics in some of my physics courses, so I'm not an expert on it, but I do know the principles involved, or the sort of recognized science behind it. And so Jones had written this paper on muon-catalyzed cold fusion. I think he'd done some experiments. A muon is a type of electron. And he basically said, yes, we can do nuclear fusion power at low temperatures. We can use various techniques to do it, but we will never get any energy from it. Forget about it being an energy source. It's just a scientific curiosity with no real, value to it. It's just something that we as scientists used as a stepping stone to something greater, kind of thing. Whereas Pond and Fleischmann were basically saying, well, look, what we've got, we think we can produce energy from this ultimately, not reliably at the moment. And this whole, if you need to sort of go on and research into cold fusion a bit to find out how significant it was, because it even caused the world price for palladium to go up because there's so many cold fusion experiments going on around the world. And even now you'll read pages on the internet which said, oh, well, it was never reproduced, it never worked. I spoke to somebody a couple of months ago, 2-3 months ago, and said, oh, well, cold fusion never works, it never reproduced. That's nonsense, absolute nonsense. We have John Bockris, a world-class electrochemist. He reproduced it with his team at Texas A&M University. And there's a video about this that you can watch called... Fire from Water, that's available on the web. I highly recommend that video, Fire from Water. It's very, very interesting. So so I realised that Stephen Hee Jones had some type of connection here, and he seemed to be playing a similar role. In other words, with the 9/11 stuff, he wasn't saying, well, 9/11 was done by Al-Qaeda. He was saying, well, yes, it was. It wasn't Al-Qaeda, but it was Thermite. So it was what we call a limited hangout. He was disagreeing with the official line, but at the same time, he was putting out essentially what was a false story. And I think he was doing the same in cold fusion. He was disagreeing with the official line that we can't have low-temperature fusion, but what he was putting out was basically something which was useless. It was meant to send people down a blind alley which wouldn't really lead anywhere. And that sort of made me realize that the Thermite story was almost certainly bogus. People still talk about it being used in the cleanup, for example, because they do use Thermite for cutting through steel, but it's very, very unlikely that they used it in the cleanup operation. Almost, and even if they did, so what, really? Because what happened to the buildings? You know, where did the buildings go? This is the fundamental question. And when you start getting involved in arguments with bombs and energy and free fall time and this and that, it takes away the attention from where did the buildings go. And this essentially then started to be the central question which came into my mind as I, you know, basically looked at what Dr. Judy had put on the table. She just kept asking the same question, where did the buildings go, where did the buildings go? And it's the question nobody wanted to answer. And I began to get a sense for that as, you know, I kind of moved through this research, as it were. And so I was then, what happened was there was a split in this scholars group. We have Steve Jones on the one side, and we had Jim Fetzer on the other. This group is essentially divided, and I thought, oh, yes, here we go, divide and conquer again. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine pointed out to me, you know, that the original scholars group had a logo, and that logo was an illuminated torch, you know, like the Olympic torch, which, of course, you know, he pointed out to me this was a Masonic symbol. And I thought, okay, all right, you know, maybe it doesn't mean, you know, what he thinks it means, but, you know. And then the group split, and they formed Scholars for 9/11 Truth, which Jim Fetzer carried on with, and Stephen Hee Jones split away into Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. And we had this big argument about the website, who owned the domain, and all this went on for months and months, and all this writing of press releases that was going on before stopped, and it was just, you know, descended into email quarrels about what Morgan Reynolds had said and what Judy Wood had said and blah, blah, blah. And I became very suspicious because they weren't really focusing on the research. It just turned into a big argument. And I was really, you know, getting more and more into what Dr. Judy had put on the table, because the questions that she put there were very, very simple, very fundamental. And she started to say, what about this dust? What about these circular holes in the tops of the building? What about these cars that were half a mile from the World Trade Center? How did they get damaged? You know, and you've got this car with a, you'd have to see the pictures to see this, but
I actually posted up the Dr. Judy Wood's website.
Uh-huh.
For those people out there who still go with the nanothermite theory, have a look at this and look at the pictures.
Absolutely.
Particularly at street level. At street level, it's absolutely astounding.
There's no
reasonable explanation for this. It defies all laws of physics that we know. It's just weird.
Yeah.
Please have a look at it. Make up your own minds. You know?
This is what people must do. They must do this because, you know, as I've realized this, you know, the point you're making there is very important, because I kind of joined this scholars group thinking that there would be credible people here, you know, people with degrees, PhDs, and they would know stuff, and that would give the group, you know, more credibility. And that's not how it turned out at all. People with these PhDs ended up trying to contradict what was right in front of their faces. They in fact ended up behaving like the mainstream media did in terms of trying to discredit the truth about 9/11. You know, and this is what these people started doing. And then what happened was, I wrote this article, Yeah, I wrote this article about the witness accounts because two of the problems here, we've got essentially two problems which people were confronted with. The initial one was what happened to the buildings, and that was one of the questions people didn't want to answer, apart from Dr. Judy Wood. And the other question that people didn't want to answer was what happened to the planes at the World Trade Center. Everyone said, "Oh, well, we know planes hit." You know, I assumed that the planes hit the buildings because that's what the videos showed. And then we started looking at things like CGI overlays and video fakery and all this type of thing. And that was all very interesting. But the fundamental question was, well, how can an aluminium wing strut cut through a steel girder? Because if you go and look at the still images from the World Trade Center, the face of it, you can see that this wing strut, which is a quarter inch thick, appears to have cut through a steel girder. Now, this is ridiculous. It's just totally nonsense. Now, I had arguments with people on the UK forum. One person I regarded as a friend who disbelieved the official story of 9/11, but I said to him, look, there's no way that an aluminium wing strut can cut through a steel girder. It's not physically possible. You know, and he was saying things like, "Oh, it just depends on how fast it's traveling." Come on, I went to the airport
to catch my flight. The TSA opened the. That's the music again, folks. So we're going for another commercial break. So hang in there. It's coffee and cigarettes on the Orion Talk Radio. See you on the other side.
Welcome back to Coffee and Cigarettes here on the Orion Talk Radio Network. We are here with Brizer and our guest, Andrew. And Andrew, I want to thank you again for, you know, coming on to the broadcast, because I think it's important if anyone has any interest in finding out some facts or truths of anything, whether it's 9/11 or any problem that this country or any other country has ever had. For me personally, I like to listen to all the different ideas. That's just for me, because in the end result, I don't know if we'll ever know who or what caused or anything happened in 9/11. I don't know if we'll ever find out the truth. I believe if we ever did, we'd go to hell in a handbasket in a quick heartbeat. You know, but I believe it's important to know all sides of information, not just one point of view. I think points of view are good if we have an open mind to at least look at them. May not agree with them, but at least look at them just to see what everybody's story is and how we can, you know, best maybe find some answers, if at all.
Well, I have to say myself, after seeing Andrew on Edge Media, I doubted most things that he said. Mm-hmm. But then I just went to the website, Judy Wood's website. I think you've got your own website, Andrew, as well, haven't you?
That's right, yeah. It's checktheevidence.com, yeah.
Right. So I checked them out, and you know, I have to say, my attitude changed completely. I thought, hang on, there's something more to this. And why aren't more people talking about it?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
How do you explain, as you said in the show, like pieces of paper flying all over the street?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
and all this molten metal and hot ash everywhere.
Well, we've got to be careful. That's what I thought. I thought there was this molten metal and stuff like this because it was talked about so much. But that sort of takes me back to where I was before the break, in a sense, because within this scholars group that I joined, or been invited to join, actually, I was doing this study of you can go. This is something you can go and check for yourselves. If you go onto the New York Times website, they've got a page where they've got 500 witness accounts of the first responders. I think it was called the World Trade Center Oral Histories Project or something, or Task Force Project. I can't remember this. The page on the New York Times website. I've written an article about this, and they're all in PDF files, and there's 500 of them. And me being me, I downloaded all 500 accounts. That in itself is tricky. If you just click on one link at a time, it's quite tricky. But I've got some software which will download a whole set of links in one go, so you don't have to click them all. And so I downloaded all of these, and I converted them into another format so I could read them more easily into text files. And then I decided to search them for keywords. And the reason why I did this was because I wanted to investigate. I'd heard various stories about the planes at the World Trade Center and what, you know, what these planes had done or not done. And some people said there were planes, some people said there weren't. It was a very strange story when you dig into it. And so I downloaded these accounts and I searched for the word plane using another program, and I read around all the references to the word plane, and I established that there were 117 people at or near the World Trade Center when the supposed second plane struck. And out of those 117 people, only 20 of them actually saw the plane coming and hitting the tower. Mm. And only 21 of them, I think, heard the plane, which is rather a low number. But
that's the thing where people have a problem with, you know, because Manhattan at 8:30 in the morning, thousands and thousands of people around, walking, going to work, whatever. But they would have seen something.
Well, of course, the witness accounts vary, but this was, you know, you hear a lot of stories on these various videos that you watch, and you can't go back, you know, to the people walking down the street and ask them because they probably wouldn't remember. And also their memory gets coloured by what they saw on television. And in fact, if you read these witness accounts, that's actually what is said. A couple of them say, for example, I didn't even know planes were involved in this until I got home and I watched it on TV, which is really strange. And it is strange. And there's another guy, I forget, I could pull this up on the screen, but it's in the article on the website. It's called Going in Search of Planes in New York City in NYC. That's the name of the article. So if you Google that, Going in Search of Planes in NYC, that article will come up and you can read these accounts, you can link back to the New York Times, you can download the file and you can check what these witnesses actually said. The most peculiar one I came across, I think, was where a guy was, I think he was either carrying a stretcher or he was carrying some equipment towards the building, and he says, I'm looking up and I see the plane hit the tower. It's like I can see the plane, I can see the fireball, but I don't hear any sound. And he says he's right underneath it. I thought, well, isn't that bizarre? So what the hell is going on? And then I go back to what I was saying before the break, in that there is no way a quarter-inch aluminium wing strut can cut through a steel girder. It's to do with Newton's third law, which is to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. In other words, the force on the plane when it hits is the same as the force on the building, right? Now, why are buildings made of steel and why are planes made of aluminium? Well, buildings need to be very strong, and planes need to be very light. Why do you have armor-piercing bullets? You know, if you can fire a bullet made of aluminium, and pierce the armored tank plate, and then you'd never have armor-piercing bullets. You wouldn't need them. You have armor-piercing bullets because they're made of hard material, and they will pierce the armor. So, in other words, it is physically impossible for the wing of a plane to cut through a steel girder. It's physically impossible. Yet, if you look at the pictures, you can forget the witness accounts, you can forget the video fakery. If you just look at the pictures in the NIST report, the official report, there is no way that those plane wing struts could have cut through those steel girders. It doesn't matter about the speed because aluminium is not as hard as steel. It's not a debate. It's not a viewpoint. It's a fact. That is fact. It's scientific fact. You can measure it in a laboratory. It's 100% repeatable under normal conditions. So the point is, I don't know what hit the World Trade Center, but whatever it wasn't a Boeing plane because it's physically impossible for it to have made those holes. And the same goes for the fuselage. The fuselage is made of light materials. So however people argue it, whatever they say, there is no way that what hit the World Trade Center was a plane. And this was also, again, proved later by part of what Dr. Judy Wood uncovered, but from a completely different angle, completely way off beam that you'd never even, you know, heard of. Once I'd established that and I started to argue like this, in other words, I initially started saying, that I'd posted on the physics forum with this calculation, and people were arguing against that. I started posting this argument on 9/11 truth forums about, you know, the plane wing struts and these sorts of arguments. And people on the 9/11 truth forums were behaving like the regular, you know, people who believe the official story. So there's something very strange going on. if people are claiming to look at evidence, you know, to disprove the official story, yet they're not willing to look at evidence to disprove the story of the planes, which can't be true as we were told it. There's something very strange going on with that. So there was something very different in my brain to those that were around me, even in those that were meant to be looking for the truth about 9/11. And even now, you'll still see, you know, these We Are Change groups, they don't want to touch the issue of planes at the World Trade Center. There's one or two of them now starting to talk about it a little bit, and a few people are suspicious, but they still largely won't touch it, despite it being a very basic, when you get to the core of it, it's actually a very basic piece of evidence that's not really up for debate once you've actually seen the evidence. You can't really argue with it. You know, you can argue about details, but you can't really argue with the fundamental parts of it. So I became what the term is, you know, no planer. I became a no planer over a period of probably about 6 months to a year, something like that. It took me. And then basically, you know, we got that coupled with this lack of building. So something very, very odd happened at the World Trade Center. And the energy effects, which Dr. Judy had started to catalogue, for example, with these cars, that was one of them, circular holes in the tops of the building. She also pointed out, for example, that the seismic signature, you know, was very small. And so that would indicate that if it was very small, then the building didn't actually hit the ground. So that would mean if the building didn't hit the ground, something happened to it before it hit the ground. So what happened to it before they hit the ground? Well, there are a number of clues. One is the dust. And in fact, what you can see is in a couple of video sequences. In fact, if you, Brian, I think, watched the Edge Media program, and I made a little video clip at the beginning of that, where you actually see 70 columns of unsupported steel turning to dust before your very eyes. Yeah. And it just turns to dust. There's no other way, as I can see it, to describe it. You know, people try to describe this as a theory. It's not a theory. It's an observation. You know, it's only a theory in the same way that the sunrise is a theory. You know, so
we've got. Sorry, Andrew, we have to cut in again there. Sorry, commercial break again. So stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. This is getting very interesting, and we'll be back to see you on the other side. Welcome back, everyone, to the Orion Talk Radio Network, and this is Coffee and Cigarettes with Breiser and Chris Kemp, and our special guest from the UK, Andrew Johnson, giving us an alternative opinion, you know, on what could have happened on 9/11, and, you know, let's go past the thermite and the controlled demolitions, and let's look at lots of other evidence out there. Andrew was saying in the break there, after watching you on Edge Media, the questions I had was about the planes, okay, and how people must have seen them.
Mm-hmm.
But then, and then, of course, there was people on those planes, so where do they go? You know, because they built all these memorials for them, and there's names of these people. What happened to them?
Well, I mean, some of those questions are very difficult to answer. And in essence, whatever the answers are, I mean, I'll give you some of my possible answers in a minute, but, you know, whatever those answers are doesn't change the basic physics of the situation. So we have to look at how those passenger stories started and what the truth behind them was. Now, the interesting thing that I can mention here is that if you watch Loose Change 2, the Dylan Avery film, there was about a 10-minute segment within that, which is basically involved with how the passengers were seemed to be disembarked at Cleveland Airport, and they went into the NASA building, and basically, there were about 194 or 195 of them on these two flights, which seemed to land at Cleveland Airport, and then they were disembarked into the NASA building. So what was all that about? And this was in the local news, so we've got that story, which needs explaining. That was later taken out of the later versions of Loose Change. We know that the passenger lists which were revealed were all different. We have David Hansch's picture where he supposedly took a picture of the second impact, and you can see David Hansch's picture. He was a photographer for the New York Daily News, and his picture doesn't have a plane in it. So the stories about the planes, there's a lot of conflicting evidence within them. And so what exactly is the truth behind them? I don't know, but all I can tell you is that, you know, it's basically, the stories don't add up. I've just had somebody else Skyping me and just trying to, that's distracted my train of thought a minute. That's why I'm just mixing my words for a bit. But, yeah, so there are things like that where I can't answer every single question about the planes, you know, and we've got the issue of the phone calls and supposedly the people like the Mark Bingham story and these people coming forward and claiming compensation and all this. I don't have all the answers to every single witness, you know, and I'd be lying if I claimed that I had. But all I can tell you is that whichever way you talk about the passengers or whatever, whether there were passengers, whether there weren't, you know, two of the flights were due to not fly that day. The other two weren't deregistered until about 2 years after the event, and they're normally deregistered within 24 or 48 hours in the event of a plane crash. That's the research by Gerard Holmgren that you can go and look at if you're interested in those things. And then there's the September Clues film, which people can watch as well, which presents some very interesting, bits of research as well, which people may not be aware of. So it's really, you know, you've got to do your own research on that. If you want to look at this story that I'm telling you about how I joined the Scholars Group, I've written this free ebook which documents all of that and what happened after I left that group as well. And that's on my website. If you click the banner which says 9/11 Finding the Truth, or if you put 9/11 Finding the Truth, you put that into Google in my name, you'll come up with, it's a free download. I've made it into an audio book. You can download the audio book if you wish. You can read through that and see what you think of it. So, there are questions that I don't have answers to. I've just got more questions, basically.
I think a lot of people have questions about, okay, these kind of strange weaponry was used. There's a thing called the Hutchinson effect. Could you explain that?
Sure, yeah. Well, right. Well, let's take a few steps forward and a few steps back and things and go into that issue more. The best person to get to talk about this, of course, is Dr. Judy. I think she should, you know, if you wanted to invite her on, I think she'd probably be willing to come on and talk about some of the details that I can't discuss as well as she can. So, you know, she would be the best person to talk about this. But we were certainly in communication talking about these energy effects, and she ended up showing me one day something called the Hutchinson effect, and which was again was very interesting for me because I was already familiar with the Hutchinson effect. I'd actually heard of it as long ago as 1999 in a documentary that I'd seen about black projects, black budget programs that should broadcast in the UK in 1999. Anyway, the Hutchinson effect, as I saw it then, was an anti-gravity effect, essentially, a levitation effect. There was this guy in Canada, this crazy guy, supposedly crazy, of course he wasn't crazy, he was perfectly sane, called John Hutchinson, and he'd been doing a number of experiments with what's known as field effects, and he'd been mixing together different types of radio frequencies from radar equipment, microwave waveguides and transmitters, and mixing that together with electrostatic fields from things like Tesla coils. He'd also used a traditional radioactive source in some of his experiments. And he'd been doing that over a period of about 10 years or so, more, 20 years even. And a team from Los Alamos National Laboratories, headed up by the now or former head of the non-lethal weapons program, John Alexander, spent 4 months in 1983 working with John Hutchinson to look at his levitation experiments. One of the other experiments that he was doing produced effects on metal, apparently melted metal, melted the metal, it jellified, but when he picked the sample up, it was cold. This is the other thing which if you look at Dr. Judy's evidence that she's posted on the website, you will see there's evidence of no heat. You know, this thing with the car, for example, we've got a car which looks to be heavily heated in the middle, but yet 3 feet away at the back, the tyre is inflated. And another vehicle, you see what appears to be blemishes on the paint. The paintwork's really badly damaged. It looks like burning, but you look inside the car and the upholstery is unburned. The upholstery is perfectly intact. So you've got some very weird patterns of damage. And these are some of the effects that were seen in John Hutchison's research. In fact, when all the effects were looked at, the melting of metal, bending of metal, the levitation effects, sometimes metal would even turn to dust. John Hutchison has done a couple of experiments where metal is fragmented quite severely. And we have ongoing effects as well. In other words, when John Hutchison finishes the experiments on the metal, the effects continue even after the equipment has been switched off. And we've seen that actually in the Bankers Trust building, which was opposite the World Trade Center. Not many people have heard about the Bankers Trust building. Opposite the World Trade Center, it was partially damaged in the destruction of the World Trade Center. Some material came across, and this anomalous gash appeared. If you look at the damage, it's not consistent with the actual way that the material came across to it. The damage on Bankers Trust building is much greater than would have been caused by one of these wheat checks, as Dr. Judy calls it. That building was repaired, I think, in 2004, 2005. I can't remember the exact date. And then, after being repaired, it was taken down piece by piece at a cost of $70 million, $70 million, rather. Why repair
hold
a building
on,
and take it down? Okay.
Andrew, hold on. We're coming up on a break. I hear the music in the background. Everyone sit tight. We'll be right back on the other side after this. And welcome back to Coffee and Cigarettes here on the Orion Talk Radio Network. Shortly after this broadcast will be question 46 with your host, John Preston. So be sure to tune in. And we're back with Brizer, my co-host, and Andrew Johnson. Andrew, continue on. And I think Brizer was getting ready to ask a question, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I was just I was looking at some of the photographs on Dr. Judy's website, and a lot of buildings had all their windows were kind of blown out, and you said a lot of these windows obviously would be double glazed, and yet one pane was broken and another one wasn't. So
yeah,
that's another strange thing. So
Absolutely. You know, this is where you know, there's that old saying, the devil is in the detail, and this is one of those things which, because people are talking about bombs and thermite and all this carry on, you miss the details, and studying the details is kind of gone out of fashion, really. I think a lot. You know, I remember being at school and people would sort of take the mickey out of me for focusing on certain details. I was too pedantic or something like that. But quite often, if you don't study the details, then you ain't going to find the truth. You have to keep looking at the details, but at the same time, you've got to try and, you know, see the big picture too, because you can miss things in that way as well. But so it's a very sort of difficult process. But as we were mentioning in the break there, double glazed units in some of the windows where the photographs that Dr. Judy had collected, only one pane is broken, and the other one is some of the windows have these strange round holes, which again is very unusual, until you begin to realize how the windows were damaged, which was with what's called a longitudinal wave, because the energy effects that were seen, some of them were within these longitudinal waves, which means basically backwards and forwards wave rather than an up and down wave. The up and down wave is like the sine wave that you see on an oscilloscope, or, you know, a traditional way that a wave is drawn in a child's book. That's called a transverse wave. This is the way Dr. Judy has worked this. This is how she's worked out what's happened. She's looked at the evidence, seen the phenomena in the evidence, tied that up with what she knows from her background in physics and engineering, and especially interferometry, which was one of her specialist areas. interferometry is where you mix different types of waves together to produce certain effects. So you know, you've got a number of these effects, like you mentioned, with the window panes, glass panes. The other one which I felt was hugely significant for me was these upside down cars. I mean, you know, a couple of pictures that she'd collected, several of them, you got a car that's the right way up and then the car next to it is upside down. How did that car get upside down? It's a parking problem in New York on that day.
Does a collapsing building cause a car to sort of...
Well, quite so. People have said to me, oh, well, there was obviously a huge explosion, but how can it act so selectively? They claim there was a huge blast of wind which came down from the towers. This, of course, is not true, because if you go and watch, again, the Loose Change film, Loose Change 2, and there's several others that I've got this in, you can see the cloud come rolling out from the buildings and people are running. The cloud is traveling not much faster than somebody runs, maybe, what, 20 miles an hour, tops 20? That's probably a fair estimate of the speed that it traveled. A 20-mile-an-hour wind is not enough to blow a car onto its side or upside down. There was no tornado, you know, strength winds at the World Trade Center. So we have to look for another mechanism for how these cars were turned upside down, which again brings us back to the Hutchison effect, because one of the effects that Hutchison was able to reproduce, and after a few years' experimentation, he was able to reproduce it reliably, despite what you read in Wikipedia, which does have an entry for John Hutchison, and it will say he can't reproduce his experiments reliably. That information is probably 15 years out of date. He was able eventually to reproduce this thing within 5 minutes of setting up his equipment by the late 90s. So we've got all these effects. We've got the levitation. We've got the jellification of metal. We showed some pictures on the Edge Media program with this beam which was held for NIST, and it's turned into like a horseshoe shape, bent back on itself. This is not come from a collapsing building. It's come from some other effect on the metal. We've got the filing cabinet, which is all fused together. It's paper and wood. Paper and metal fused together in this filing cabinet, the only one that survived. This is exactly the effect that John Hutchison has, where he's got a piece of wood embedded in some aluminium. I mean, how do you do that? It's not possible to do that, because if you melt aluminium, the wood will burn if you melt it with heat. So the thing, that was one side of it. As I said, I was in this scholars group, and I started to write some articles about the Hutchison effect in relation to what Judy had posted. In fact, I think I wrote a press release. And this Jim Fetzer character started to get rather nervous, shall we say, about me doing this. And he eventually tried to say that what I was saying was childish, because I disagreed with him about the evidence. And another associate of Jim Fetzer, a character called Ace Baker, then set out on a kind of pernicious debunking campaign against John Hutchison, saying that he was producing all the effects with strings and wires and trickery and video fakery and all kinds of things. And this all started within hours of Dr. Judy and I going onto a radio show in Washington, D.C., a local radio show, and basically, you know, going through the details of what I've just described in summary here. This story is all, as I say, in this book that I've written. It's called 9/11 Finding the Truth. It's a collection of articles that I wrote in a period of 3.5 to 4 years. So you can read all the details of how this unfolded. And I did it deliberately, because I was pretty sure at that time that there was an important story unfolding. I didn't quite, you know, get all the significance of it. But I knew that the energy cover-up was connected to the 9/11 cover-up. Once I'd seen the connections between Stephen E. Jones and cold fusion, and in fact it seems that the Hutchison effect is related in some way to the cold fusion effect. It's some type of nuclear effect, that's one thing, and I think it's to do with something called ether physics of the ether. Now, the idea of the ether was basically discarded when Einstein came along. And once Einstein came along, everyone said, oh, there can't be an ether. You know, the ether is just a fantasy. It doesn't exist. But actually, That's one of the cover-ups in science, that the ether does exist, and there is obviously some group somewhere that knows exactly how to manipulate the ether. They know all about ether physics, but they keep it to themselves. And we know that they know about it because the World Trade Center is no longer there. That's why it's not a theory. We know that there is a group, some group. We don't know who it is. We don't know whether it's, you know, Bilderbergers, Zionists. We don't know whether it's Jesuits. We don't know who it is. But we do know that they know about this physics. They've developed a weapon. They've used it, and it worked. So we know that because the World Trade Center is no longer there. And when you look at the evidence, it's not really up for debate. When you study it enough, you'll see that it's the only way that the evidence can be explained in all its detail. But then Dr. Judy will, she put a request into NIST, and she requests for correction into NIST. And we
sorry, Andrew, sorry, we have to cut across again
okay.
there.
Yep.
Had a commercial break, coffee and cigarettes. We'll see you on the other side.
Welcome back to Coffee and Cigarettes here on the Orion Talk Radio Network. We are here with our guest, Andrew Johnson, Breiser, and myself. And Andrew was made a kind of a funny joke. I kind of wonder if he'd go over that one again because we missed the punchline during the break.
Well, the punchline is,
well, I got it.
The punchline is vote.
Okay.
Sure, you have to think about it.
Yeah. You should hear the question, people. You might want to repeat the question to the audience just so that they get a clue.
Well, it's are the audience ready for such a a smutty joke, shall we say?
Oh, I'll go for it. What do the Chinese do when they get an erection?
That's right, vote. Yeah.
That's a scary thought, my friend.
It is. So, yes,
the Hutchinson effect we were going on about, and
indeed
the significance of that, and the fact that there's this energy source out there that has been misused by whoever they may be.
Well, that's it. I mean,
this is
the big one, because the Western organized, you know, cultures that we live in run on energy, primarily oil, you know, coal, and fossil fuels, and a lot of people in the control grid make a lot of money. And not only that, it's a scarcity-based economy. And then we get into situations of wars over resources, you know, because things are scarce. But when you look at what Hutchinson can do and the Hutchinson effect and what it ties into, and these energy effects, for example. And this goes back to the time of Tesla, because John Hutchinson was trying to reproduce the work of Tesla. Tesla discovered that there are ways of getting energy out of the vacuum, out of the ether, in fact. That's what this ether physics is about. If you know how to do it, you can get as much energy as you need out of thin air, right? And that's why the cover-up for what Dr. Judy has been putting on the table is so powerful. Because it's the big one. It really is, guys. This is the big one. This is the secret that has now been irresponsibly disclosed by the people running everything that has to be kept secret. They have to do everything they can to help people not to realize that the big one is now out. We know that we can get energy out of thin air. It's real. It's not a theory. Because the World Trade Center is no longer there. Because if you look at the evidence, you can see that the only place where the energy came from to do what it did to those buildings was from within the material itself, or from within the environment, from within the ether. In other words, it wasn't burning, it wasn't bombs, it wasn't a nuclear explosion going off, it wasn't it being hit with a plane, it wasn't gravity, it wasn't any of those things. It wasn't fluorine gas, as Sophia Smallstorms has suggested after she made the film 9/11 Mysteries. I had to write an article about that one and have a bit of a chuckle over it. This energy came from somewhere else, and that somewhere else is where we could get all our other energy. And if we could do that, if everyone knew this secret that I'm telling you, which is no longer a secret, then we really could change the world completely. All the control grid and all the control mechanisms would be obsolete. They would break down. That's what's on the table now. And that's why it's...
And there's another interesting aspect of all of this, too, is a lot of people might know this, but there was a hurricane off New York.
Precisely so. Precisely so. This is what's important about details, because Dr. Judy, you know, she'd tell the story better than I would, but she was looking at why the plume of material was rising, because if the building had turned into dust, it should have all this dust should have fallen to. Let's just say it turned to sand. I mean, when you're on the beach and you throw sand in the air, it comes down again. It doesn't continue floating up in the air, does it? But what Dr. Judy noticed, because she studies the details, is that some of the building started going up and continued to go up. And then she noticed that some of the building that had gone onto the ground started going up into the air by itself after a few minutes or hours. I can't remember the exact figure. So the material that the building was made of was somehow broken down in the destruction of the building. And if you get, Dr. Judy's written a book now, several years of work have gone into this. You can get this from Where Did the Towers Go? It's a textbook. So, you know, it's a hardback book, 500 color pages. WhereDidTheTowersGo.com. You can look at this and you can look at what I'm telling you. She lays it all out in there, the dust rising. So this material was continuing to break down. So this energy effect was continuing to occur after the building had been destroyed. And we think it's still continuing in the ground now, you know, 10 years later, which is why they haven't built anything of any significance on the site. Well, they've rebuilt World Trade Center 7, of course, but where the towers were, there is no new building. And I think if you look at Building 7, there are no glass windows in the lower floors. It's like got the lower section of it with, I think the windows start about, I don't know, 8 or 9 floors up or something. So it's a very unusual building, the new Building 7. I'd forget what it's called.
I haven't seen that now. I have to have a look at that.
Yeah, yeah. I walked past it.
I didn't think it was rebuilt. I didn't think it was rebuilt.
Yeah, they rebuilt it. And they had a concert. Suzanne Vega was there. That was in 2005, I think. There's a big concert and stuff. But the main, where the towers were, the Twin Towers, there's still no building on that site. And same with the Bankers Trust, as I say, that's been dismantled. But going back to the hurricane, Dr. Judy found this hurricane on satellite pictures because she was looking for this dust, what the dust was doing. She noticed it was going up into the atmosphere. So she thought, let's go and have a look at some satellite pictures. And on one particular one, there was Hurricane Erin. And it was 500 miles off the coast of New York. And then she went and looked at the path that it took. And it started on September the 1st. In the Atlantic, moved across to Bermuda, as these hurricanes often do, and hit Bermuda on the 7th, did a bit of damage. It was reported by CNN. Then they said, don't worry, it's going out to sea, nothing to worry about. And yes, it was going out to sea in a straight line, and it arrived closest to New York City, 8 o'clock in the morning, on 9/11, and it reached its largest extent in terms of the size of the storm system, and it started moving the slowest as the events of 9/11 were unfolding, and then the next day it made a right-hand turn and headed out towards Newfoundland and went in that direction. So you have this hurricane there, seemingly, you know, to make a quotation, reporting for duty on 9/11. Now, listeners can go and look at the evidence and make up their own minds what significance they think that has. If they want to dismiss it as a coincidence, that's absolutely fine. That's entirely up to them. I certainly can't dismiss it as a coincidence. And if you look at if you look at what a hurricane is, it's obviously a storm system. What's in a storm system? Well, lots of electricity, lots of electrical charge, which is exactly the same as a Tesla coil. So it's field effects that we're talking about. And field effects is exactly what John Hutchison was talking about. And when you talk about 9/11, no one will talk about the hurricane. No one will talk about the Hutchison effect. You go onto the internet and Google, you look for articles which mention Dr. Judy Wood and mention Hurricane Erin and mention the Hutchison effect. You try and find some articles written which mention those three things and that are not disrespectful, and they don't use the word crazy, they don't use the word fruitcake, they don't use the word, you know, any of these sorts of words. You try and find some articles, I'm betting that you will find less than 5 articles on the whole of the internet which mention those things, and probably all of them will, most of them will have been written by me without trying to blow my own trumpet. No one will talk about this. No one. Jim Fetzer wouldn't talk about it. The people in the scholars group wouldn't talk. No one will talk about it. People who are interested in chemtrails won't talk about it. So there is something very, very strange going on. The hurricane is not a theory. It's a piece of evidence, which is all that's on Dr. Judy Wood's website. She doesn't talk about theories. She talks about evidence. And this is what
A lot of people would say that they remember 9/11. It was a beautiful sunny day, clear day.
Yes, yes.
So where was the hurricane? Or, you know,
well, yeah, the hurricane.
Surely
exactly.
They would have noticed.
They think they would have noticed. But if you go and look at the weather reports, you'll see that dry thunder was reported at all 3 New York airports on 9/11.
Okay, Andrew, we'll continue with that on the side. Coffee and cigarettes, everyone. I hope you're enjoying the show. With Andrew, great information. We'll be back in the next segment, final segment.
Welcome back to Coffee and Cigarettes here on the Orion Talk Radio Network. We are in the last segment of the broadcast this evening, and I want to again thank Andrew Johnson for taking the time out to come on. And we will have you on again, Andrew, guarantee that, because you bring out some interesting information. So I really want to thank you for coming on. And just a little quick light housekeeping. Next week, next Sunday on March 6th, we will have a special guest. This guest, I have already confirmed it. He will be on. It is Professor Griff from Public Enemy. Now, some of you have never heard of him. Professor Griff has been exposing the underbelly of hip-hop. Or should I say, it's Illuminist or Masonic roots. Matter of fact, I believe Professor Griff was kind of hip to things that were going on. There's a video on YouTube called Pawns in the Game. If you have not seen that, I suggest you do. And if you have not seen any of Professor Griff's interviews, they're all on YouTube. He's a very interesting gentleman, and he brings information that helps us understand what's happening in the world of music, especially hip hop. Who is Jay-Z involved with? What is he involved with? Who are these casts of characters that we see on our television screens, on our video screens? Well, he's going to go into all that with us next week and hopefully educate us on some things we don't even know about. But I want to pose a question. And like I said, we're going to have Andrew on again because I think he brings some interesting information to the table, which is very coherent. None of us have all the answers to anything, Reiser, Andrew.
No.
None of us do. If I did, I'd be a rich man and probably sitting back quiet somewhere in Tahiti. But I don't. But here's one thing I do know. If you are a person or individuals that thrive on warmongering, lying, dividing people, causing and wreaking havoc, if you're into racism of any form, of any sort, if you're into biting people up, if you're into infighting, guess what? You're part of that problem called the New World Order, which is nothing but the Old World Order. You are part of that freaking problem. And there are some solutions that we can all work with. We don't have to agree on nothing. Not a damn thing do we have to agree on. But one thing we do need to do is stand together. Because if we keep dividing each other by race or by sex or by creed or by any religion, then we are freaking lost. We are literally lost. Because we're doing what the globalists want us to do, infight, backstab, lie. That's what globalists do. They infight, backstab, and lie. And half the time they cause it. And half the time we cause it. You want to know who's supporting the New World Order? Look in the freaking mirror. You want to know the answer? You want to beating these bozos? We can all look in the mirror.
Well said.
Have we fed anyone hungry? Okay. Have we fed anyone that needs some food? You want to piss the New World Order off? Or the globalists off? They hate this. Go feed someone. And you don't have to go to a homeless shelter. Go buy a sandwich for someone. If someone out in the cold, warm them up. Give them a hot cup of coffee. Ah, the globalists really hate that. You know why? Because they want us at each other's throats. They want us cutting down somebody who's homeless or doesn't have a home or doesn't have food to eat. They want us doing that. I, for one, don't serve that group. I don't serve any group. But I try my best to help my fellow man the best way I can. I'm not going to backbite. I'm not going to backstab. And I'm sure not going to lie for you or lie on you. Because if I do that, then I'm part of that globalist system, and I don't want any part of it at all. And I don't want anybody around me that's part of it. Bottom line, you want to beat the globalist butt? Feed somebody homeless? Take somebody in that's hungry? Go talk to somebody who doesn't know about change. Talk to somebody who's having a problem being beaten up or who's a drug addict or something. Do something instead of freaking complaining and not doing a damn thing. Do something. But if you come to divide, if you come to lie, if you come to backstab, the New World Order has applications and they're ready to hire you. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and listening in. Briser, Andrew, any last word?
Well, I'd second everything you said there, Chris. Absolutely. I mean, this is it's up to us, each and every one of us.
I think
we're in control of our own destiny. You know, Andrew, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think this. I'd just like to sort of say my interpretation of what John Lennon said: if you want peace, be peaceful. You know, that's how I would summarize it. Do peaceful things. You know, he said, do anything for peace. You know, go to bed for peace, or, you know, I just say if you want peace, be peaceful, and you know, that will stop the agenda.
Right. If you want love, give love.
Yeah.
If you want hate and war, join the globalists. Join PNAC. Join the Brooks Institute, join the CFR, join whoever if that's the type of person you are. Bottom line, just the way I see it. I'm sorry, but that's just the way I see it.
Yeah. I say we have to look at everything too. You know, Andrew said we have to look at the bigger picture. We have to look at the detail, and sometimes you can get bogged down in the detail, but you have to pick something that bothers you. And go for it and get the answers, and then you take it forward.
I think, you know, as well, what we're dealing with are people who are obviously, they've got more resources than we have in terms of time and money and intelligence, really. We're dealing with people that they've worked this out very, very carefully, and we've talked about, you know, the things that I've talked about today, they're all true, you know, but I can say that because I studied it. Other people can't say that because they haven't studied it. So, you know, you've got to invest a lot of time. When you study it, you realize that you're dealing with some group that's got a very powerful capability to do what they do. And the way that they've engineered the cover-up and the way that it works, they know human psychology, you know, they can manipulate it so, you know, carefully and so accurately, down to a T, and they can play people like a fiddle over and over and over again. And I think some of what Chris was saying can help you be not played like a fiddle if you can break out of that cycle, and then you can start to see things and what's really going on, you know. And so that's what I encourage people to do: really think for yourself and look at the basics, you know, and don't get angry with people, don't call them idiots. Just keep looking at things until it makes sense to you. And if you can't make sense of it, stop thinking about it and go back the next day and look at it again. You've got to persevere with this. You know, to uncover what's happened, essentially, a few more people are starting to listen to what we've been saying. You know, Judy Wood was saying this in 2004, 2005. I didn't understand it for probably two, three years after that. So here we are, 10 years down the line, and a few more people are now finally starting to get it. That's the sort of complexity and cunning that we're dealing with. You know, but people are trying to start to suss it all out now because of programs like this and all the other stuff. But you still got to be open that some of these things are manipulated too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Andrew, thanks a million for coming on. Great information.
Thanks for inviting me.
We'll do a part two, maybe a part three.
Sure.
But we're definitely a part two because there's more. The hurricane thing is very interesting. So.
Yep, Dr. Judy on, and we can ask her about.
Oh yeah, we can get her on too. Yeah, definitely, we'll do that. Yeah, without a doubt. So, Chris, final words.
I've already said my final words. Bottom line, love is the only thing that's going to make any difference. Love, unity, peace. If you want love, give it. If you want peace, live it.
Mm-hmm. That sounds good.
That's it. Most important things in life are not things.
Thank you, Bryzer. Exactly.
That's it. So
we hope everyone enjoyed the broadcast. Like I said, we'll be here again next Sunday. I want to thank again Jimmy X for that little commercial he did for our show too, Bryzer. That was kind of cool. So thank Jimmy X. Thank Orion Broadcasting. I want to thank again Andrew and all the chatters in the chat. Hope everyone had a great time. Hope everyone had a good debate going on in there. I like seeing good debates because that lets you know people are thinking and thinking for themselves and using their heads. That's what I love to see. Mm-hmm. You know, if people can actually debate and still maintain being friends, then everything is all worth it, brothers, sisters. Everyone be peaceful, be loving, and just remember, there's nothing new about this order. Nothing new about the world order. It's all old.
We'll get there in the end, folks. We just have to keep trying. We can't give up now.